next case on calendar this morning is docket number 68630, Sataquoy Bay LLC versus Durango 104 versus Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. And just as another point of housekeeping, Justice Pickering is voluntarily recused from this matter. All right, counsel, are we ready?
Yes, sir.
All right, Ms. Gilbert, if you'd like to approach, and do you want to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. Jacqueline Gilbert, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Jacqueline Gilbert on behalf of Sataquoy Bay, appellant with Karen Hanks and Jesse Panoff. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes if I may.
All right.
This court should reverse the dismissal of Sataquoy Bay's complaint because the district court erred as a matter of law in concluding that the noticing provisions of NRS 116's judicial foreclosure statutes unconstitutional. The bank failed to protect its interest and now it asks this court to, number one, abandon the SFR decision, number two, ignore constitutional law by failing to identify a state actor that caused the deprivation of which it's complaining, thereby not even invoking due process, and it has waived that argument on appeal, and to ignore the constitutional avoidance doctrine. This court should reverse and remand because the statutes are constitutional, they don't violate due process or the takings clause, and the alternative argument of commercial unreasonable cannot support dismissal under Shadowwood. This court in the SFR decision unanimously found the incorporation of 107090 through 116.31168 to exist. The district court ignored it. The Bourne Valley Court, which I understand was given as supplemental authority out of the split Ninth Circuit panel decision, which is not binding on this court, found the analysis of the incorporation to be somewhat meaningless. This court said in SFR that the provisions of NRS 107090 governing notice to junior lien holders and others in deed of trust foreclosure sales apply to the foreclosure of an association's lien as if a deed of trust were being foreclosed. On the same page, the court said, NRS 107090 subsection 3B and 4 require notice of default and notice of sale to be sent to each other person with an interest whose interest or claimed interest is subordinate to the deed of trust because it's applied as if a deed of trust were being foreclosed, you would substitute association lien for deed of trust. But most importantly, as then Chief Justice Gibbons stated in the dissent, as the majority points out, by incorporating certain notice provisions of Chapter 107, Chapter 116 appears to mandate the association mail the notice of default and notice of to the first security holder who have recorded their security interest when the association is closing on its lien. To suggest this court cannot have been more clear. There is an incorporation, it applies 107090 as if a deed of trust were being foreclosed, the noticing provisions. But the district court ignored that and found the statute to be facially unconstitutional, essentially writing out 31168 and 107090. SFR was a facial analysis, despite the bank's argument to the contrary. This court stated that in view of the fact that the requirements of law, which are in the foreclosure deed, include compliance with the noticing statutes 116.31162 through 31168, and by incorporation 107090, we conclude that U.S. Bank's due process challenge to the lack of adequate notice fails, at least at this early stage of the proceedings. We're at the same stage of the proceedings. You could not have made the court could not have made that statement without noting that notice was required to be sent to junior lien holders, including the bank. That there was no requirement for the bank to opt in or request notice. Therefore, this inquiry should stop now. This court has already interpreted the statutes, and it should allow it to reverse and remand with instructions to continue litigation in light of current binding case law. But even if this court was to continue, due process is not implicated for lack of a state actor. The district court ignored it. There's no findings of a state actor in this case. And while the Bourne Valley Court in the Ninth Circuit seemed to recognize that it had to have the state actor component of the Lugar test, it ultimately ignored it. Wells Fargo did not analyze this section of the test. It did not even cite Lugar in its brief. It has waived any argument on the issue. The state action test under Lugar is two parts. One, deprivation by some exercise of a right created by the state, and conjunctively, party charged with deprivation must fairly be said to be a state actor. Enactment alone is not enough. And they gave a reason for that. Without a limit such as this, private parties could face constitutional litigation whenever they seek to rely on some state rule regulating their or governing their interactions with the community surrounding them. To ignore the state act requirement would say that any casino, any resort that is in the state, when it interacts with the public, is subject to constitutional litigation when it's simply following the rules and regulations set up by the legislature. And that is not the purpose of constitutional litigation. It's where the state is interacting with the public, not the public with the public or private parties with each other. Both prongs are required. To have a state actor, you can have a couple things: overt, significant impact by a state official, such as a judicial foreclosure, such as a sheriff's sale, such as a writ issued by the clerk of the court for garnishment, but none of that exists in non-judicial foreclosure. Or you can have where the government has turned over a traditional and exclusive function of the government to a private actor, and we don't have that here. In Flag Brothers, the U.S. Supreme Court said, private use of a state-sanctioned private remedy for procedures does not rise to the level of state action. The Ninth Circuit in Sharmacore, reviewing 107 foreclosure statutes, said the statutory authority of a trustee to foreclose by sale, given by statute, does not transform the private non-judicial foreclosure into state action. That was recognized again in Apayo some almost 20 some years later. It confirmed that the source of a right is not what you look at for the state actor analysis. It's who's doing the action. And as Snowden, as Judge Jones from the U.S. District Court stated in Snowden v. Preferred RV, the power to impose fines and enforce liens is not a traditional and exclusive government function. So the HOA here is a private actor making a private decision whether or not to seek to recover delinquent assessments using a private remedy that is defined by statute on how to do it, and using a private trustee, not using a government official. There is simply no overt, significant government, state official, or government action in this at all.
Ms. Gilbert, could I ask you this on the Bourne Valley case? Are you involved with that case, your law firm and all?
I am now.
Okay. So on the status, I assume there's a request for en banc reconsideration by the Ninth Circuit of the three-judge panel decision. So that's pending, I assume, right now.
That's pending, and actually an order was issued yesterday ordering a response to the petition.
Okay. So you're suggesting that since the Ninth Circuit's decision is not binding on us, we get persuasive authority as far as this court is concerned, that we should just proceed with this case without even dealing with the Bourne Valley issues raised by the Ninth Circuit?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would absolutely say that, as this court has recognized multiple times, it isn't even binding on this court. So, and because it is now, there has been an order for a response, and there were three amicus briefs filed, including from the Legislative Council Bureau.
Thank you.
If the bank is suggesting that the mere enactment of the statute is what caused its deprivation, then we're in the Legislative Acts Doctrine, which is a whole different doctrine, and there was notice in public hearings at the time it was noticed. But there's a timing issue here, because the statute couldn't have deprived Wells Fargo of its interest in this case because Wells Fargo didn't have an interest. Its interest didn't arise till 2003. The statute was initiated and enacted, became into being for 1992, and the CC&Rs in 1994. So it's known ever since it gave money in the state for this loan that it was going to be subject to an HOA lien. So again, without a state actor, this court to end its analysis, due process is not implicated any more than it is in 107, as Sharmacore noted. So I think that that's where it should end. But even if we're going to look at the statutes and look at the district court's order, what I have here is simply, so if we look at the actual statutes we're talking about, and I have given a copy of this to opposing counsel so they have it to see. What you need for due process, if due process is implicated, is statutes that are reasonably calculated to apprise an interested party of the pendency of the action and the opportunity to be heard under Mullane, and mailing satisfies that under Mennonite. The legislature drafted a constitutional statute. We're in this side of the statute. You have four statutes that are at issue. Wells Fargo is, in this case, the recorded security holder. They have been on the deed of trust all along. So we're over here in 107, 090, and 31168, where it says each other person with an interest whose interest or claimed interest is subordinate to the deed of trust, read HOA lien. We're here on this side of the statute. They are required, mandated, to receive the notice of default and under four the notice of sale. But they would have you write this out of the statute completely because they say it renders this surplusage. The problem is it doesn't. These are actually different classes of people. Under 107090, you have subordinate lien holders of record. Under 311631, the request notice is a term of art. It's defined under 107090. And that's a formal request for notice that's recorded. The second sentence that comes after here, and I ran out of room, in 107.
Actually running out of time, too.
If you want to keep going, that's fine. So here we have, I will reserve the remainder if I can just go slightly over. I'm in my 4 minutes, correct?
You're at 319.
Okay. Request notice is anybody who wants to get notice. Any holder of a recorded security interest who has notified could be not recorded. MERS is a perfect example. In the MERS case, they can assign those deeds of trust all over the place, and the holder may not be the holder of record. Fannie and Freddie claim to have interest in many deeds of trust, yet you never see them recorded. That's who these people are. They can request if they want to because they can't be found. These are not the same, and there is no surplusage. If you find that there is surplusage and something would need to be written out, you write out the part that's not constitutional. You keep the part that keeps it constitutional. The rest, I believe, the takings argument is in the briefing, Your Honor. I believe this is the primary part of the argument, unless you have other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, thank you for the chance to address you on these issues. May it please the court, Andrew Jacobs and Kelly Duff for Wells Fargo. I'd like to try to discuss three points with you today. First, why there is state action here. Second, why the level of incorporation of 7.090 is not, as is claimed by counsel. And third, what state action that exists here makes necessary, we think, a determination that a taking has occurred under the federal constitution. First, looking at state action, they properly quote for state action two controlling Ninth Circuit cases, Sharmacore and Appau. I'm at a bit of a loss as to why Bourne Valley isn't deemed of equal dignity with those. Last year, the Ninth Circuit reheard en banc 9 of its 14,000 appeals, and it surely may. But the fact that they've moved for that, and the fact that, as is routine, we're going to respond to that, does not make it a fait accompli, as they might wish that that will occur. And right now, you have Sharmacore, you have Appau, and you have a panel of the current Ninth Circuit that interpreted those cases to explain what state action means here. And it's a very clear distinction in the law, and one I think that was well anticipated wisely by the SFR dissent. In Appau, Judge Schroeder wrote that the statutes that are at issue in those cases are all, quote, the legislative approval of a private self-help remedy. The whole point in the state action analysis, every case that they talk about, is all a case where A and B have a pre-existing economic relationship. And there it's ordinary. You get to come back under the deed of trust or the contract and deal with liens in that way. The state, in effect, gives a rules of the road when A and B already have an economic relationship. What is fundamentally different here, as the Bourne Valley panel appreciated, is that you have state action of a fundamentally vaster and greater character. For the state created the substantive right. The state, in essence, created the debt, as it were, that is subject to the dealings between A and B, because the state created the super priority. And as the Bourne Valley opinion noted in its last paragraph before conclusion, it's as between strangers here. It's fundamentally different. And so the Ninth Circuit properly held, and under Sharmacore and Appau, where you have the legislative approval of prior economic dealings with the parties, there's one level of state action involved, where the state creates the substantive debt or economic transaction between the parties. That's fundamentally greater and different.
Mr. Jacobs, before you continue your argument on state actor, where in the district court's opinion did it address or identify who the state actor is?
It did not identify with particularity where the state actor is.
In your brief did you respond to who the state actor is in this case?
We did analyze the state action issue, Justice Hardesty.
And not the way you're discussing it now.
The state action exists under here because there is necessarily an action by the state enacting the statute in the first instance. And
really, so the Ninth Circuit in Sharmacore, the Fourth Circuit in Levine, the Northrop case out of the Sixth Circuit in 1975, and the Appau case, all hold that non-judicial foreclosure procedures do not amount to state action. Where did you argue that those cases should not be given credit here on the question of whether the adoption of 116 is itself state action?
Justice, we argue that in particular there's a fundamentally different character of action here as represented in the takings argument that we made and the due process argument we made.
I'm asking, did you make that in the context of state action? You would agree, I presume, that under the precedent in Lugar and Flag, that there is supposed to be a second element, that being a state actor. So are you contending here that the enactment of 116 in its statutory construct constitutes state action, and that's the state action?
It is the state action, and that's consistent with Lugar. At page 937, there's a three-leveled understanding of what state action is. And it's the state runs out and does it sort of in a vest that says state. There's you're working with someone wearing a vest that says state. And then there's conduct that is otherwise chargeable to the state. And the fundamental difference between all the cases about prejudgment attachment and the cases that involve the pre-existing economic relations is that with that element completely lacking here, you have action of a fundamentally different character. Those cases simply don't control, and Bourne Valley, which we cited to this court, explains that distinction persuasively.
So simply by enacting a statute, that's in all senses state action?
Not necessarily in all cases, but where it results in the taking away of property here without a regime that mandates notice, yes.
Where does it stop? If it implicates a licensing issue to where someone might lose a license over a statute that was passed? Is that a taking? This, you're basically saying any statute that has been enacted by the legislature that may result in some type of a loss of property right, or is a taking or a due process violation?
Chief Justice, we understand that the state has a broad-ranging power to license, and a license is just that. It's a revocable opportunity to participate in a trade, like my ability to appear before you. It's a revocable license. Your property rights have a fundamentally different and more important character, both in the federal and in the Nevada state constitution. And to take away somebody's somebody's property rights, Mr. Chief Justice, is a fundamentally different attribute. We're not saying that it slides all the way to the bottom of the slippery slope. If you take away property in a regime that doesn't give a mandate of notice here, which is the case in this case before Your Honors today, then that is state action where the state creates the economic interchange. It's fundamentally unlike under a deed of trust, having a non-judicial foreclosure under a deed of trust. Those parties aren't strangers. They made a contract. They made a deal. If I don't pay the mortgage, you can come and take my stuff. Wells Fargo never made a deal with Sadikoi Bay that its mortgage lien, which is a federally protected property interest, can be extinguished by their fiat. And that's a fundamentally different deal.
A number of things you're inserting aren't part of the record in the lower court, so I have a little concern as you slip and slide them into the argument. But as the taking issue and what you just stated, wasn't the enactment of this, did it precede the loan? Are they not aware? So how do we get to this taking?
Yes,
jurisprudence.
And Justice Douglas, I remember us having an exchange about this in Rooney Park, and I was hoping to have the opportunity to respond to this question with you today. As we outlined in our brief, there's this concept of the delegated private taking, where Nevada can give the power to a utility, can give the power to a company to come through your yard and take part of your yard, and they're going to have to pay money if they do that, because that's how it works when you take somebody's stuff away. You would not think that in that kind of an instance where the government is giving to an intermediary the power to take your stuff, you would not think that the fact that in 1991, Nevada passed a law saying a pipeline can go through your front yard means that if you buy your house in 1996, you don't get compensated under the statute. That is precisely analogous to what happened here. The statute is passed. A private actor has all the authority of the state to take away my property. That happened later and after I had a prior, previously existing lien.
But is this not different because the taking is for failure to do something that the party had an obligation to do, which is pay their HOA dues?
Well, the taking here in this case is simply the act of the government moving private property from A to B. The Fifth Amendment doesn't really...
No, let's go back, because clearly, as you're talking about, yes, if we have a taking, there's a right of compensation, if it's clearly that. But what about this other obligation that the party has some responsibility for and is just flat omitted?
The Fifth Amendment...
Do we still get under the Fifth Amendment with that? What is your position?
But due process is notice and an opportunity to be heard. Taking is the government moves your stuff from A to B. And we have a very long existing legal culture that the government can't buy fiat.
And you're saying the government is taking your property, and you're, in that context, you're saying by creating the statute allows the HOA to enforce its super priority and erase the deed of trust.
It's a delegated private taking. It's a springing taking. The government is giving the entire bundle of rights it has to affect the property dealings between the parties. And in their brief, they just say, but it wasn't called eminent domain. Well, that makes it worse, not better. The fact that they don't own up to the fact that they're redistributing property and that we lose a lien worth $100,000 or $200,000 and receive no compensation doesn't make it any less. The government picking of winners and allocating favorites and picking them over us. And the takings clause does not permit that. And your 2006 enactment, the pistol, makes even more clear that this state has a higher bar for protecting private property rights. And here, you have a complete extirpation of our interest. We are completely evicted from our interest over this physical parcel in Nevada.
Mr. Jacobs, let me ask you this, and I'm thinking of this as maybe an analogy. Maybe it's a good or bad one, but let's say the situation was where Wells Fargo had a first deed of trust, and the owner wasn't paying the property taxes, and the property tax lien from Clark County is superior to the deed of trust, you know, like that. how is this that different than the Clark County foreclosing upon its property tax lien, which would extinguish the first deed of trust that your client would have in this situation? How would you differentiate them?
I differentiate it because if you have a tax lien, you just have to do what it says in Mennonite. And we've discussed before, as in Rooney Park, that the notice regime here is not compliant with Mennonite because it doesn't guarantee that in all cases a method is used that is to apprise people. But sure, there are ways under tax lien statutes that you can fairly do that, but you have to give notice to the affected parties. This statute doesn't do that. And if I could, I'd like to use that opportunity to respond briefly on the statutory construction issue. The page 411 of SFR versus U.S. Bank does not bear the interpretation that counsel states in this court it must bear. There's a series of declarative sentences explaining how the statute works. And there's a series of statutes that says you must give notice if, under Section 68, notice is requested. You must give notice to someone who asks under 63 and under 63.5. The sentences you must give notice if and you must give notice to someone who asks cannot be true statements if they really mean, as they suggest, notice must always be given in every single instance. Those sentences would not be true sentences, they would not be true statements, they would not be logical, and for them to be the original and signal statement of how this statute operates in SFR versus U.S. Bank is why the dissent was correct when the dissent suggested that there had to be an action creating formal notice and an opportunity to be heard. And that's the distinction Bourne Valley picked up, and that's the distinction your legislature picked up last year when it put a notice requirement into the statute, plainly indicating its belief that notice requirement was not present. Bourne Valley indicated that you have to have true notice and an opportunity to be heard, like in Mennonite, like in that tax lien situation, and that opportunity was not here. And they talk about it being a split decision in the Ninth Circuit. Well, Judge Wallace is the one taking their position. Judge Wallace, in his dissent, very, very strikingly, did not say this court decided that 090 was incorporated with full notice requirement in all cases. He didn't say that. It's nowhere to be found in his dissent. There was mention of the amicus brief filed 2 days ago by legislative counsel at the instance out of session of, I think it was the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Roberson. That brief, amazingly, goes through and does two things. It, after page 2, where it says SFR was decided in 2014, it never says this court explained .090 was notice that was fully incorporated. And more than that, they suggest that the question needs to be certified back to your honors because it's, quote, novel, which they say three times.
Counsel, as to 116.3116, there seems to be a deficiency in your brief that you really didn't address what they put forth. So why should we even entertain that this day?
We argue that the statutory construction is that it is an opt-in notice statute. That is our position in this court, Your Honor.
Cogently respond to the argument they made. It's missing in the brief.
My argument, Your Honor, is that since then we've had development in the law where the Ninth Circuit found that section decisive in how
Would
it construed those.
Submit supplemental as to that.
Your Honor, when we say the entire statute is an opt-in notice regime that is not constitutionally sufficient, that is our argument in our brief, and that's our argument in this court, that it is an opt-in regime, the Constitution does not permit or honor an opt-in regime, and that cannot be constitutionally sufficient. If you have a regime where your First Amendment rights are respected except in the breach because the police have the opportunity periodically to have you not exercise them, just because that doesn't occur one day, because they mail notice metaphorically, doesn't make it constitutional. The regime must require that in all cases, a method is used consistent with Mennonite, calculated to apprise everyone of the opportunity to protect their property. Your legislature, very importantly, 41-0, voted effective October 2015 to make the statute do what the dissent suggested it would do. And there's a really important argument that you had, Your Honors, between the dissent and the majority opinion that is seldom focused on in litigation here. It was this question about whether the foreclosure of the sub-priority lien and super-priority lien could be different. The dissent suggested, I think correctly, and I think it's been proved correctly, that foreclosing the super-priority lien should be different because a judicial proceeding would have to be going into effect. And the majority said, well, why the distinction? That'd be weird. Why would you want to foreclose the one non-judicially and the one judicially? The whole answer, consistent with Bourne Valley, is that you have a fundamentally different relationship In the sub-priority piece, you have parties in contractual privity who know they can lose their stuff to each other. In the super-priority piece, you have a constitutional difference because you're reaching there to make A take B's stuff where they are strangers to each other. And that is state action, and that is why this is special. And there aren't a lot of cases like this to cite because legislatures don't typically enact statutes that confer a substantive right to allocate A's property to B and then do it with a Mennonite deficiency as to the caliber of notice required. And it's a goofy situation, and your honors have really, you know, worked mightily to deal with it and argued through these issues. But 2 years later, your legislature and the Bourne Valley decision show that as a matter of federal constitutional law and the legislature's prerogatives, the project of the SFR majority was not ultimately sustainable. And the hundreds of millions of dollars shifted from securing obligations of ordinary Nevadans to speculators, we respectfully suggest should end now.
Okay, and my last question for you is your opposing counsel indicated the Bourne case is absolutely non-binding in this instance. Do you agree with that?
No less or more than Charmacore and Appau. It's a good guide as to state action, and just as federal courts should be. Sorry, Your Honor?
Just permissive authority that can I think be considered.
It's persuasive, but clearly not completely controlling. You're the Nevada Supreme Court, but they are the expositors of federal law, as in Charmacore, Appau, and Bourne Valley.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Justices.
Any other questions? No? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Ms. Gilbert, you got 2 minutes and 24 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First on taking, this is a regulatory taking, and therefore you have to have a reasonable investment-backed expectation. They had none after the enactment of the statute. And therefore there is no taking here. They would have, they've always had the ability. The second part of this is they did have an ability to protect themselves. So, and they chose not to. In the cases that they rely on, there is no way for means to for protection, and those interests arose. They already had an interest that were taken when the other cases like Radford and Security Industrial Banks were, when those enactments came forward. There is no taking here, and they didn't take something from one to the other, because what would have determined who had priority, et cetera, in the absence of the statute, would have been the CC&Rs and the liens arising out of the CC&Rs, where there is relationship between the CC&Rs and the homeowner. And this is no different than where you have a second deed of trust under 107. There is no relationship between the first and the second, yet the first can wipe out the second. And before 1989, did it without notice. When they adopted 107090, the part that says each other person with an interest or interest is claimed interest is subordinate to the deed of trust. That's when that came into play. This is no different. And that's why this works. It was adopted in 1991. And it brought it in. And they keep saying there's no mailing under Mennonite. Mennonite says mailing is satisfactory. In this case, the mortgage on file with the county recorder identified the mortgagee only as the Mennonite board. Mailing a letter would be satisfactory. They're saying, ignore this. They're telling you constantly to ignore this. They are of record. Wells Fargo was of record and would have received notice under 107090. This court knows what it did, what other people say or didn't say that it did. It knows what it did. It recognized the incorporation of 107090 in its entirety, including subsection 3B and 4. As far as a state actor, they waived it. They never addressed this issue. They seem to be claiming that there is a taking.
Finish your thoughts.
We talked about legislative acts. Unless you have any other questions, I'll submit on the brief.
Okay. Colleagues, any other questions? Okay, Ms. Gilbert, thank you. And counsel, we very much appreciate the good briefing in this case. And your arguments as well. The matter will stand submitted.